Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
It's hot out now, isn't it? Deathly hot, humid, and I want you to think of India. India hot, steamy hot in the jungle, and the way they hunted tigers in the old days, with beaters and drums, and men carrying sticks of fire. The days of Kipling, and linen suits, in the hot sun, and hats, and ties, sitting up there on elephants, waiting to fire your gun. It was the days of Kipling and the British Raj. And my favorite Kipling line, when Afghani was confronted by these strange creatures with their linen suits and their hats and ties in the heat. Who are they? They take their hats off to women and they give names to dogs. They're Englishmen. An Englishman hunted the tiger. With the beaters, as I said, a great vast area, they'd circle around and begin in a line and push forward closer and closing the circle with their drums beating, driving everything before them. The deer, the buffalo, the wolves, the jackals, the monkeys, even Mowgli, and of course, Shere Khan too, the tiger. Is Mike Madigan the Shere Khan of the modern age in July here in Chicago with the FBI beating the drums in his jungle? Boss Madigan is seeing his friends go down in raids. Michael Zalewski, the former alderman, had his house raided. Alderman Burke, close friend and confidant, has already been charged with racketeering and other crimes. Kelly Quinn, the political operative close to Mike Madigan, who handled, I think, some of that David Krupa nonsense in the 13th Ward when they did all their affidavit games to try to knock Krupa off the ballot for alderman against Quinn's brother Marty. And Danny Solis, another Madigan guy, 25th Ward, engineered that meeting that was on federal tape with a hotel owner in Chinatown with Madigan. So yeah, you want to think about that? Shere Khan, Michael Madigan, the drums. And you don't hear them, you know? You don't hear people say it's Madigan. You hear it, Madigan aides, Madigan friends. But every time you hear that, know that the noose is tightening. And the FBI is closing in. And those tough Irish-American FBI agents with their cold blue eyes, like warrior priests, beating the woods for Michael Madigan. Today, we're going to have Jim DeRogatis, the former critic of the Chicago Sun-Times, music critic, the one who broke that R. Kelly story. And we're going to have Michael Warren Davis, who wrote a provocative piece in the American Conservative, "Welcome to the Hellfire Club. Our elites cavorted with the pedophile, almost certainly aware what he was up to. This is how revolutions begin." I've talked about Versailles and Washington and Madame Guillotine in the past. Mr. Warren Davis will talk about it now. And also Jason Meisner, former leg man and federal building reporter for the Chicago Tribune, while on vacation with his two kids and his wife, still dreaming of oysters on the East Coast, crafted a great story while, I guess, on the way to the airport about R. Kelly being arrested and how this thing begins again with R. Kelly. Jeff Carlin is here, WGN producer of the Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis. He engineered that perfect last podcast when we were on live. I hope you listened to it. And again, he made it into a podcast afterward. And me, I'm John Kess, husband, father, Greek rib maker, columnist for the Chicago Tribune and member of its editorial board. And you know where you are? with the drums beating for Michael Madigan as the tiger snarls and tries to find his way out of the forest safely? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
We begin by talking to Chicago Tribune reporter par excellence, Jason Meisner, who is so dedicated to bringing you the news of the day, the truth of things, that even on his vacation, he wrote a story, I guess on his cell phone, about R. Kelly and the arrest and the federal case against him. Jason Meisner, Chicago Tribune, welcome to the Chicago Way.
Hi, John. How you doing?
So tell us now that Jim DeRogatis is all up in arms and his fans are all up in arms. How did Jason Meisner scoop the story? Tell us how that happened. You and Elizabeth and the boys, your two young boys, you're probably still thinking of oysters, right, on the East Coast.
Yeah, we'd gotten back from a week's vacation in Rhode Island. Lobster rolls. Lots of fresh swordfish. But anyways, we knew something was coming. I had kind of figured the way these things happen, it would probably happen on my vacation, which it did. And it broke kind of late at night, 10 o'clock at night on a Thursday, when our night reporter had just left. So I just jumped on it. That's all. It was breaking in New York, and it was breaking in Chicago. And I was working until 2 in the morning that night, trying to figure out, you know, what happened, where was R. Kelly, and when was he going to appear in court.
So Jason, set the scene. Where are you when you're working this? Are you sitting in an airport lounge, or are you...
No, I was home. I was leaving the next morning for Wisconsin, though. I got back from Rhode Island, and I was had one afternoon and evening at home, so I was on my laptop. It was...
With Elizabeth getting the kids ready, saying, "Jason, honey, I need you. We got to, pack the car.
Cooler's not going to pack itself."
Right? And you're like, wait
luckily,
a minute.
Luckily son number one had just gone to bed. So, because otherwise, it's tough to work on a breaking story when you got two munchkins, like, grabbing one on each leg. But it was, it worked out because they had just gone to bed. But, It was unusual the way it unfolded. They arrested R. Kelly. He was walking his dog outside the Trump Tower where he has his apartment. And they whisked him to Dirksen, and he appeared. I found out late that night. I was trying to find out when is he going to appear in court. It turned out he already had. He appeared in private in the chambers of Magistrate Judge Finnegan for his initial appearance. It wasn't a public hearing, which was unusual. And so we found that out about midnight and tried to figure out what was going on.
Whenever I get arrested by the feds, I want to in private. Okay, can you arrange that, please? Yeah, keep going.
I also heard that he was on his way after he walked his dog. He was supposed to meet people at Gene and Giorgetti's that night. R. Kelly was, so he never got his steak.
The veal chops are superb, as you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and then, of course, we were trying to figure out on the fly what was going on. There were charges in New York, but they were under seal. Then I got a copy of the indictment here, so it was 4 intense hours of reporting, I would say.
I'll say that was, I mean, that story was struck in, and you were like, holy crap. But we saw, a lot of this we saw coming, though. I mean, we had talked to Michael Avenatti months ago, and he alluded to this.
Because Michael Avenatti, if I'm ever going to compare someone to Jason Meisner.
Michael Avenatti. But my point is that this has been in the works. This was something that we were all kind of steaming towards, whether we knew it or not. But I just love the idea of Jason unpacking, repacking, packing, unpacking, and then, oh, by the way, let me break a little news if I can, or at least get the scoop on some news if I can.
Did you put before the first call came back from the editor, were you putting the high chairs and stuff in the van, or how did you, right. You know?
Yeah. No, I said we had suitcases everywhere. Then I got to take off for Wisconsin, and the Tribune reporters picked it up from there. Megan Crapaud covered his hearing, and they did a great job. I had a Saturday story and Sunday recap.
Yeah, there was a great team effort all around, and I know you're not taking credit for yourself. Yeah. That's not how it's done, and you're a pro's pro, Jace. And I have to say, Mr. Meisner, now when we talked to Jim DeRogatis, I've got to endure the fact that the Tribune did not really jump on the R. Kelly story. It's true. For years, I didn't either. I think I may have written a column where I have to feverishly look for one if I did. What does it mean?
Jim has always been adamant that he wanted the entire Chicago media to pick up the torch and go with it. And meanwhile, it was him and Abdon over the Sun-Times,
right,
who broke a lot of those stories early on. I was a brand new reporter at City News, 2002. R. Kelly was my first national story that I helped work on when he got charged. So pretty much my entire journalistic career has been spent in one way or another having this guy on the radar. But D-Row got us stayed on it, and now here we are.
The what does it mean for Judge Vaughn and the other people who were in law enforcement, in the courts, lawyers, etc., at the time when they start peeling this onion back? I know that's speculation. I'm going to ask him to speculate, but is there any credible reason to think that they might be going into all of what happened back then with, you know, Eddie Jensen and Sam Adam and all that?
There is mention in the, you know, I just got back from vacation, so I have to read the indictments in depth and figure some things out, do some more reporting. But there is mention of a lawyer, and we don't know who the lawyer is, but this is back at the time of his trial in 2008 on child porn charges. And there's mention of a lawyer who was out there working on his behalf to try to get witnesses to change their testimony. There's also mentions of massive payouts to recover these videos that were out there, hundreds of thousands of dollars they paid people to try to get them off the streets and contain it. And then, of course, there's lots of allegations about not only implying violence, but physical violence against some of these minor girls that he was allegedly abusing. So that's the New York indictment, which we think is going to be the one he's tried on first. This is the racketeering charge. That's the one that alleges this long-standing conspiracy to traffic minor victims and to cover it up.
Jason Meisner, keep up the good work, even if you are on vacation.
I'm back now. Thanks.
And we missed you on our live edition of the Chicago Way, so next time we get that chance, we'll have to hear some wing stories.
I want to tell the story about how John and I took a box of cannoli down to Bridgeport to a mobster's house. That would have been my story if I had a chance to tell it.
Leave the cannoli, take the Meisner. Yeah, definitely. That's right. A good story. The FBI and the Chinatown crew appreciated it. Thanks, Jason. Thanks a lot for being
all right,
here.
Thanks.
See you, man.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
I believe I can lie. I believe they can't catch.
You've seen the R. Kelly story? R. Kelly's arrested. Feds are all over R. Kelly. Well, years ago, in 2000, there was a music critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. He went up against R. Kelly and R. Kelly's machine. Jim DeRogatis, formerly of the Chicago Sun-Times, now full-time professor at my, I guess, not alma mater because I didn't graduate, Columbia College, and also co-host of Sound Opinions on WBEZ.
It's a pleasure to chat, John.
So what kind of pushback did you and Abdon Palish get when you started pushing on R. Kelly and saying you had the tape? There was a tape.
Yeah. We didn't have the tape until February 2002. Our first story was December 21, 2000. We honestly thought, drinking at the Billy Goat, waiting for the first offs, that, the story we had spent 6 weeks of 18-hour days, 7 days a week, killing ourselves to produce, would shut this man down from hurting other young black women in the Chicago community. It was old news in 2000. His first victim was 1991. That's documented with a civil lawsuit. If you talk to five women on the Chicago South or West sides, John, four of them will have stories about Kelly cruising Kenwood Academy, the other high schools, the Evergreen Plaza shopping mall, the Rock and Roll McDonald's when it was on Clark Street. This was never a secret. Nobody cared. Nobody cared to stop it because the money was too extensive.
And he had, in court, he had Eddie Jensen, right?
Sam Adams Sr., both proud to call themselves mob lawyers.
And they know, especially Eddie, when he sprinkles that magic dust from his cane and it goes all over the judges and they see things his way.
There was a story a couple of weeks ago that Neil Steinberg went to visit Mr. Jensen, who is dying of cancer. And it's sad. And Steinberg just went to chat about the old days when Eddie grew up as the son of a bail bond clerk. And Jensen said, "We all knew Kelly was guilty as hell." Guilty as hell was the headline. You know, this is a man who always made sure that the pictures of his grandchildren were front and center whenever he held a press conference in his office. How, since that acquittal in 2008, he's been able to look at himself in the mirror, knowing that other young girls were being victimized, for another 9 years after they got him off. And now we know how he was acquitted. He was acquitted because he paid the girl in the videotape and her mother and her father and bribed them to lie to the grand jury and not to testify in court. That's in the federal indictment. You know, we've always wondered, how did he get acquitted with 26 minutes and 39 seconds of video evidence of crystalline clarity? You know, John, many rumors now, you know, people say, oh, the video was hazy, furry, fuzzy. No. It was shown in court a dozen times. It had come to me at my home on the Northwest Side. Everyone knew who the girl was. Everyone knew how old she was. Two dozen witnesses testified that they knew of this relationship, including her aunt, her uncle, the uncle's wife, who was a Chicago police officer. The Chicago police had been investigating him for 2 years. Some incredibly hardworking cops who were disgusted by this behavior. When we wrote our first story, I'm telling you, I know you're not a historian of popular music like I am. The history of pop music, there has never been a criminal sexual abuse charges so wide, so broad, so long lasting. Never against anyone. And, you know, we now have documented evidence in two federal indictments and the Illinois state charges, 21 there, 18 from the feds, of, you know, this guy is a supervillain Chicago has produced on the level of John Wayne Gacy or Al Capone. And I'm not being hyperbolic when I say that.
One thing we have to understand, I think I understand it, and Jeff does, and anyone who's a journalist understands it. I don't know if listeners really get it because they're not working in this field. When you go after somebody with clout and juice who makes a lot of money for a lot of people, you get pushback. You get serious pushback. So tell me about it. What kind of serious pushback did you get?
As I said, we really thought we'd done the job December 21, 2000. We were vilified in all of Chicago black media, you know, especially the radio stations. They never stopped playing him. They said it was old news, although much of what we reported was new.
And you were racist and you were...
We were racist, and our colleague Mary Mitchell wrote more than two dozen columns, a black woman, ferocious columnist, wrote more than two dozen columns telling the black community, urging the black community to wake up to the predator in its midst, and defending me and Abdon Palish. We were two white reporters, but we rang doorbells throughout the South and West sides for weeks. And with one exception, we were invited into people's living rooms, and mothers and family members, and in some cases the girls, cried and showed us the scars on their wrists, showed us the hospital bills where they had tried to kill themselves with pills, showed us the damage, showed us the pictures, and said, thank you for listening. No one has ever wanted to listen to us. And, you know, I think the bravery of the women who have been speaking out since 2000 is extraordinary, John. And the fact that few other journalists, and I won't let the Tribune off the hook.
Okay, please don't.
Other journalists rang those bells. You know, it was never hard. Like I said, you talk to 4 out of 5 women on the South or West sides, they have stories. Not necessarily that they were approached, but they saw him in action. And, you know, the churches allowed it. Reverend Jesse Jackson and James Meeks were getting money for Rainbow Push. They stand by him to this day, although they won't go on the record anymore. The civil attorney, Susan Loggins, settled some dozen claims out of court. Only the first 4 were public record, and took money rather than aiding the prosecution. You know, Judge Vincent Gaughan, who also heard the shooting trial of Laquan McDonald by Jason Van Dyke, allowed 6 years to lapse as the defense dragged their feet and tried to delay the day in court. And during those 6 years, John, it's extraordinary in the history of 26th and Cal criminal court building. Every 6 weeks, he would hold a status conference, convene prosecution and defense in his courtroom, and immediately retire to closed chambers. The record of everything that happened during those 6 years, every 6 weeks, remained sealed. He, you know, ruled consistently in some 123 motions that remained sealed for the defense. He threw the case to Kelly. And, you know, he didn't allow any evidence by prosecutor Shauna Boliker, who is now on the bench, and her colleagues to bring in any evidence that the girl on the tape and her parents were paid off. Didn't allow any evidence that this was a pattern of behavior. This was not one girl on one videotape, but he successfully reduced the case to that.
Will the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office pull at that piece of the stinking onion and talk and think about the corruption that may have occurred?
I think so, because the indictment already points out that the girl and her parents were bribed. And there are obstruction of justice charges. The witnesses that couldn't be bribed were, according to the federal indictments, threatened with violence, physical, mob tactics. We will break your legs or kill you. A manager, Daryl McDavid, and an assistant, June Brown, are indicted. But the New York indictment names managers, assistants, drivers, hangers-on. There's a long paragraph enumerating how many people in Kelly's orbit. They call it a criminal enterprise. This is really unique. I mean, in my knowledge, in the history of popular music, you know, the Rolling Stones were not charged under RICO as a criminal enterprise. No one ever was. So this is going to be a unique argument, that the system that enabled him and never derailed the gravy train of he earned $250 million himself in his career, and he earned $1 billion for his record label, Jive Records. If I was the former president, now retired, of Jive Records, Clive Calder, if I was Judge Vincent Gaughan, I'd be worrying how far will these charges go. And when Kelly's enablers begin to flip and turn state's evidence to avoid prosecution themselves, what else will come out? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the federal indictments end the story. It's been 19 long years of reporting for me, or it will be in November. And I'm done. I wrote a book. It tells the story of how he got away with it for 30 years. The churches, the schools, the courts, civil attorneys, all failing young black girls and journalists. There'll be other scandalous revelations. There'll be other news stories. The trials will take forever. This won't end soon, but it really is finished, John. Finally, after all these years, 28 years since the first victim, 1991. She was 15. She sang in the choir at Kenwood Academy. He would visit Kenwood Academy. He attended for 1 year but never graduated. And he would pick up sophomores in Lena McClinn's choir class.
Jim, you talked about a lot of the aspects of this, but I have to ask you, you mentioned briefly journalism. And you mentioned properly that Mary Mitchell and you two, obviously Mary Mitchell supported it. But where did journalism fail? And were there journalists in Chicago that actively worked against you? Because I can tell you from doing political work that there are people out there that do blogs and other, you know, I call them ruffiani, which is kind of an Italian, a Greek-Italian word for gossips. And they work their gossip. And they work against you when you're trying to do something right. And did you have that too?
Yeah, and I don't want to whine about nobody believing me. I mean, I got plenty of hate, you know, from Pitchfork when I criticized them for booking him to headline their festival in Union Park in 2013, half a mile from one of those living rooms I sat in with a distraught mother. You know, I was fat, I was old, I was clueless, I was pompous, I was moralistic. But John, the women who spoke, the hatred they got on social media, they were whores, they were liars, they were gold diggers, they were fame hungry. I mean, that's nothing, you know, what I went through is nothing compared to the vilification of those women. You know, the Tribune, in the course of our, you know, after our first investigative report in December 2000, after the tape in February 2002, and the indictments of Kelly for making child pornography in June 2002, and the six-year wait for trial, they ran three stories about him finding God, turning to the Lord in gospel music. Three. And I won't name the reporter. He's somebody I respect. Obviously, I do a radio show with Greg Kot. Greg saw his role as a critic and not as a reporter. And the New York Times.
The New York Times.
Stone and,
They loved him.
No,
they
I mean, my book is full of examples of critics saying, you know, despite all the unpleasantness with R. Kelly, he's a genius. Unpleasantness. You're talking about child rape. That is far more than unpleasantness. You know, it horrifies me, and it really particularly pains me that as a journalist and as a music critic, you know, I had a long talk with Ebert, who I really admired, you know, and you know, he said, I do not see how people could ever write about Triumph of the Will without talking about it depicts hundreds of thousands of Nazis who are about to destroy Europe and try to exterminate entire populations. You can't just review that movie without saying the evil at its core. And yet that was the case with Kelly, because from day one, Honey Love, his first hit in 90, all the way to I Admit, a track he released last summer, which admitted nothing and blamed the parents for pushing their daughters at him. You know, it was in the music. When he began a sexual contact with Aaliyah when she was 15, his big hit protege, and then illegally married her on a Cook County marriage certificate, falsified license out in Rosemont at a hotel, you know, he had written her album and titled it. And it was titled Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. It is in his art, all of it. And for no one to have looked at that, you know, he was telling us the South and West Side women were telling us, many people were telling us, the Baptist power structure wasn't listening, the courts weren't allowed to listen because of the scope of the evidence that was narrowed. The cops were listening. They tried hard, man, I tell you.
Cops tried hard with Jeffrey Epstein, too, in Florida?
They did.
What do you make of that? What do you make of that with Kelly as parallel, Epstein and Kelly, parallel tracks, both of them beloved by the elites? Roman Polanski.
I think that what's becoming obvious now, there was a good piece in the Los Angeles Times yesterday by my friend Lorraine Ali. It's becoming obvious that it is never one predator. It is a system of people that enable a predator to do his thing for years, for decades. The Epstein and Kelly similarities, and there's not a coincidence. My feds who will occasionally talk to me, not with great detail. It's not a coincidence that those charges came within the span of a week against Epstein and Kelly. They are now looking at the sex trafficking statutes and realizing that there are patterns of behavior, and they are not sparing law enforcement that went errant in the case of Labor Secretary Alex Acosta, taking a plea deal that like, geez, you and I have gotten harsher for traffic tickets. almost. I exaggerate. Or Judge Vincent Gaughan. I think, he's going to retire and wish to disappear very soon because, his behavior in the McDonald Van Dyke case was scolded by the Supreme Court as patently unconstitutional, and he was not allowed to do the same thing of sealing records. But he did it and got away with it, and the appellate court and the Supreme Court allowed him to in 2008. And if we finally opened the public record of the Kelly trial, the 6 years before it was in open court, what else would we find? We would find, and I have this on solid sourcing throughout my book, Solus, we would find that he consistently just, ruled in favor of Jensen, Ed Jensen, the defense attorney, and the Adams, the senior and junior. And, Sam Adams Jr. made his name on this case. If we, all along 90 on the south side, on the north side, there are these giant billboards now. Sam Adams Jr. will fight for you. Yes, just like he fought to get a pedophile acquitted. I don't know. He has children, too. I don't know how he looks at himself in the mirror and shaves.
And Jim, in the couple minutes we have left here, we got to get to something that with John kind of sparked on Twitter in the last few days.
Really frosted you, Jim. I know.
the Jason Meisner R. Kelly scoop. We got to air it because I know some people were tweeting John, taking shots at John, seemingly unfairly.
That wasn't fair. Jason Meisner was on vacation, and the feds are a prickly bunch, and they play it real close to the vest. They didn't hold a press conference. There were some 50 FBI agents and Homeland Security investigators working on this. I first broke that there was a federal investigation in February in the New Yorker. And Jason was lucky. They called him and said these charges are coming, or somebody called him and said Kelly's been arrested Thursday night. I didn't get the call. I tried so hard to get the feds to tip me,
Maybe Jason has a different view, I would just say.
Jason's a great reporter, I will tell you, when I vilified the Tribune, Morgan Green, Megan Krepow, Tracy Swartz, Jason Meisner have been doing extraordinary work, Sam Charles and other people at the Sun-Times. There's a new, I'm 54, John. I'm teaching at Columbia. Some of these were my students. Sam Charles had been a student of one of my first classes. I'm incredibly proud of the hardworking, they're running all over Chicago now to tell this story. I wish I was never proprietary on this story, and neither was Advent, neither was Mary Mitchell. We were begging, screaming, wondering, where is the rest of the press corps, national and local, on this story? It was very lonely for many of those 19 years, and I'm glad that that's not the case now. When a story is this big and so many people are being hurt, the hell with your scoop. The story has to be out there. There should be a small army on it, and now there is. So Jason Meisner has my incredible respect. Megan Krepow, Sam Charles.
I have to say that in the 20, I'm not into pop music, okay? And in the 20 years that I've been doing this, I should have written more columns on it, and I didn't, and I count myself as one.
There were two subcultures involved. You had to know the music world, and you had to understand black culture. There are so many people, John, for whom Kelly's music was their high school prom song, was their wedding song, was the soundtrack of every backyard barbecue. And as with Michael Jackson, and especially given both of their roots here, right, in our community, the love felt for Kelly or for Jackson, and it's part of your life. To now suddenly reject him is to reject that your wedding song that you danced to was his. I think these all made it really complicated factors. Jeffrey Epstein, unless you had millions of dollars to invest, you were never going to encounter him, but you felt like you knew R. Kelly because his music was your life. You know, and I think that was really hard for many journalists to understand, and still to this day. You know, when people defend Kelly, I understand it, because we're asking them to turn off a part of their own life.
I'm not going to defend them.
I can't. I mean, I think anybody who reads and really understands that the charges, you know, because this federal case, the trial will go on. Like I said, there'll be more scandals, there'll be more revelations. But for all intents and purposes, he's never going to be a free man again. Both New York and Chicago are asking that all bail be denied, given that there is a history of obstruction of justice methodically charted through bribes and threats to witnesses. I don't see that the judge grants bail. Plus, he doesn't have any money. You know, he has spent $250 million that he earned paying off women and hiring lawyers like Adams Jr., you know, for the last 30 years. He's broke. He has not had a hit since 2013. Nobody cares about him anymore. If he was still at the top of the charts, if he was still generating that kind of income, I don't believe we'd be seeing justice still. It's coming now because he's finished anyway.
And on that point, we have to leave it there. Jim DeRogatis, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate the great insight on this. Check out the book, Soulless, the Case Against R. Kelly, out now. Obviously, Sound Opinions on WBEZ. And, of course, my alma mater, Columbia College professor.
At least one of us graduated.
School is starting again way too soon.
Well, Jim, thanks again. We always appreciate your insight.
Thank you very much.
Our next guest is Michael Warren Davis, who in the American Conservative, one of my favorite magazines, wrote an amazing story titled "Welcome to the Hellfire Club. Our elites cavorted with a pedophile, almost certainly aware of what he was up to. This is how revolutions begin." Mr. Davis, I've long compared Washington to Versailles, and I've thought that we should all watch nationally the movie Ridicule, which is about the just before the French Revolution, when ridicule was the coin of the realm. And I wonder, I see your piece and I see others mentioning revolution. It seems like it's seeping into the American consciousness that we are seriously in a bit of difficulty in our republic. Yes?
Yes, that's right. Now, the point that I wanted to make was this is a real social context that leads to mass, you know, dissatisfaction with the political system. I mean, it's disillusioning. You can literally lose faith in the Democratic Republican project. And what I was saying was, you know, conservatives need to be tackling this harder than anyone, because if we don't sort of, you know, flush out the really bad guys in our own elite groups, then it's going to radicalize people. But what's interesting, though, I guess, is that of all the emails that I've gotten and people that I've spoken to, what they seized on is this idea that, you know, this is the stuff that revolutions are made of. And people have come to me, lots of people have come to me saying, you know, I really am at getting to that point where my opinion is eat the rich, and it's really not more nuanced than that. And that is troubling, but I think it proves my point.
Well, we have on from the left, we have the eat the rich, and that is really growing strong. Before, it was just a fringe element of kooky Marxists, and now it's the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Mm. And on the right, we have contortions where we contort, you know, Trump will give us the Supreme Court justices we want, and the economy is good. So therefore, we excuse a lot of what he does. And in the middle, and then conveying all this information is a media that is more like, I guess, Kemalists. I call them Kemalists, those in New York and Washington. They're more like palace guards protecting the regime rather than iconoclasts. And so what else could we have but a mass disillusion? And then add on top of that the failure of the Roman Catholic Church with the sex offending of priests.
No, that's right. That was and I guess the big word here is clubs. We saw there is, it's in sort of Catholic media circles in my day job as an editor at a Catholic magazine. We call it the Lavender Mafia. It's the group of high-ranking cardinals and bishops in the Catholic Church who systematically preyed on seminarians and altar boys and got away with it because they would protect each other's secrets. The other club is, you know, what they're calling the Varsity Club. The celebrities and other, you know, wealthy, beautiful, influential people who were paying to get their children into Ivy League schools, completely undeserved. And then there's the, you know, the Hellfire Club, you know, the Jeffrey Epstein circle, and the many, many, many powerful men, from Bill Clinton to Prince Andrew, who, if they didn't participate in his debauchery, you know, almost certainly knew about it. It's very hard to make the case that all of these people were completely ignorant of his proclivities, especially when, as you mentioned, especially when people like President Trump strongly hinted at knowing exactly what Epstein's proclivities were. He said in that 2002 interview with New York Magazine, you know, it's been said that that Jeffrey Epstein, who's a terrific guy, is is almost as fond of beautiful women as I am, and many of them are on the younger side. And it's just, it's impossible to believe that's an innocent comment. As I said in the article, this is why when people say, you know, the system is rigged, and when people say that, you know, that you know, you can't trust the elites, well, they're not entirely wrong. They're not coming from nowhere. The question is, what do you do with that anti-elite sentiment? Do you use it to win elections? Do you call it, you know, populism and just bang on endlessly about reform? Or do you actually reform? Do you say, you know, I'm a Republican, but if there are bad guys in the GOP, I'm going to go after them as hard as I do the bad guys in the Democratic Party. I don't know how willing people are to sort of check their own backyard for skeletons first before they go after the other guys.
Well, we have been instructed on how to behave by the Democrats a while ago when it was Clinton who was, you know, one of those Jeffrey Epstein frequent flyers, was found to have basically desecrated the Oval Office. American feminists, women, stood, I think there was one who famously and probably to her everlasting shame, but I don't think they can be shamed, talked about passing on knee pads to other women, right? She was a feminist writing, I think, in Time magazine. I forgot. I've wiped her from my memory and used bleach to do it, but they instructed the rest of the politic to be how to behave. Enjoy your power and protect it, even at the expense of what you're talking about. No?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. I try not to discount the Me Too movement too much. And I think that there is, I mean, I'm a social conservative, and that's sort of my main cause in journalism. And I try not to discount the things like the Me Too movement too much, because, you know, I do think that when you have a culture that's as saturated with pornography and sexually explicit content as ours is, and when the sort of the pervading ethic is one of sort of live and let live libertinism, then it totally makes sense to me that powerful men feel that they have a right to sexually exploit the subordinate women. We don't want to blame women for or any victim for the really terrible things that are done to them. But at the same time, you know, our society has many, many defense mechanisms that are built into sort of our social mores that have been torn down. You know, one of them absolutely is the idea that men have to treat women with respect. You know, that all that stuff about not kissing on the first date, but on the other hand, you do have this, you know, people don't seem to realize that very often what we would call the puritanical sexual ethics of the past were just as often to protect women from men and to not encourage men, because you know men are we are, as we say in the Christian faith, you know, we're fallen. And when women say, and you know, anti-feminists always criticize women for saying that, you know, men are fundamentally sexist or something like that. They're not right. They're actually not wrong. From a Christian perspective, men are fundamentally sinful, and that is an absolutely incurable part of the human condition. The problem is that it extends to women too. Women are also fundamentally sinful. And as a conservative, you know, I believe that our political and social and cultural structures, you know, in the what we call the Judeo-Christian West, were erected to sort of save us from ourselves.
As we tape this, high above Chicago, there's a story that's percolating the headlines and making news, and it's R. Kelly. It's the artist who has been haggard for decades now by accusations and innuendo, and then charges. Now there's a federal case residing here, and it involves obstruction, and it dives harder. And as we talked to with Jim DeRogatis, the idea that the system let this happen, the system let him go, the system, and we're going to see more and more of that understanding and how seemingly a cabal, if you will, of attorneys and publicists and who knows, working to keep this under wraps, just another shot across the bow as we move towards a revolution. What do you make of cases like this? Do you see people seeing these things as eye-opening or going to ring the bells of revolution as we move into the Harvey Weinstein case, which will come to the forefront later this fall?
I really do hope that it's eye-opening, because there, again, it's really not something you can debate at this point. There is some sort of structural injustice at work here, where you know the rich and powerful do get more lenient sentences. You know, the defenders of Jim Acosta, and I'm not an expert on this issue, but defenders of Alexander Acosta, the recently resigned labor secretary who was the U.S. attorney in Florida who oversaw Epstein's prosecution in the early 2000s, his defenders say that, you know, to go back a little bit, he oversaw the prosecution of Epstein, as we know. And Epstein wound up serving 13 months for sex trafficking. And this caused an outrage. And eventually, Acosta had to resign as labor secretary. Now, people have said convincingly that Acosta really had his hands tied because, you know, Epstein's attorney, Alan Dershowitz, was intimidating witnesses, and so Acosta couldn't prosecute because he didn't have anyone willing to come forward and accuse him. Well, look, then you have, if that's true, then you have a celebrity dream team of Epstein and Dershowitz who are intimidating witnesses with impunity. That you would think that if this was just some, you know, some low level African American thug in Chicago who was actually intimidating witnesses, I mean, he would get the book thrown at him, and rightly so. But somehow, you know, the Epsteins and the Dershowitzes, the wealthy, the powerful, the famous, they fly right under the radar. This should have, if Epstein's prosecution was, you know, if Acosta did all that he could, then there has to be, we have to ask, why is that the best that he could do? Why couldn't justice be served? This question doesn't go away.
And I think to that point, it's, you know, it really took really good, hard journalism to bring the Acosta thing to light. But in more and more, we're seeing such a collapse in people's appreciation or respect for journalism. And it's making it seemingly easier, you would think, the things that are happening right now, the Acosta things that are going on currently, or the R. Kelly-esque things that are going on currently. I mean, we never know. So those things may never lead to a revolution because there's so little faith in what's media.
Revolutions. That's how you have revolutions. Sure. When all of the institutions are thought of as sodden with infection, correct? I think.
That's right.
Listen, that's right. I must ask you also that, and both of you, just a few, we've changed our attitudes with R. Kelly and Epstein. Just remember, only a few years ago, Roman Polanski was getting a standing ovation in absentia after he had raped or allegedly raped a 13-year-old girl and fed her with drugs and then raped her. And he was thought of as, you know, by Meryl Streep standing up there, and they loved him just like she loved Harvey Weinstein as God, she said. And then we had all sorts of other bits in Hollywood where children were sexualized. Woody Allen, you can see I'm going from my column issue here, but Woody Allen also was applauded for his creation of roles in which middle-aged men had sexual affairs with 14, 15-year-old girls. What's happened? What's happened to that part of it, Mr. Warren? How's that playing out now? Can you make a film like that?
You have to wonder at some point. I don't think that Roman Polanski and all that, the starlets applauded. You have to assume, at least I certainly think so, that the people at home were pretty shocked by that. Ordinary people do not give people, do not give celebrities a pass for this brutal behavior. There were the Michael Jackson fangirls who lined up outside the courthouse to defend him. But I think the overwhelming majority of people, even who liked Jackson's music, were appalled by his behavior and wanted to see justice served. Is it Hollywood trying to check themselves and say, people are not willing to let us sort of run rampant over people that are less powerful and wealthy than we are, we'd better. And is that the origin of the in some ways exorbitantly overcorrection against that, so that culture of sexual abuse, or is this just celebrities that are bored and don't have anything better to do, and so they've tried to start a social movement? Is this a way of sort of dodging blame by shifting the focus on particular individuals like Harvey Weinstein, a bad guy by all accounts, so that we ignore the culture of abuse in Hollywood? Or equally as likely, is this just these celebrity activists who have known about this for years and only just recently decided to come forward? Are they just playing activists? Are they just playing at being a radical? Because it's something to do. Yesterday it was Save the Whales, and now it's Save the Women. It's hard not to be cynical.
It is, and I would also recommend everyone read Mr. Michael Warren Davis's piece, Welcome to the Hellfire Club in the American Conservative, and find him whenever you can at the Catholic Herald. He is an associate editor there, and you can reach him at www.michaelwarrendavis.com. Thank you, Mr. Davis. Thank you for being
you,
here,
sir,
on the Chicago.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
For Michael Warren Davis of the American Conservative and his essay, Welcome to the Hellfire Club. For Jason Meissner, federal building reporter for the Chicago Tribune, for bringing us that great R. Kelly story while he was on vacation. R. Kelly investigated and charged. And for Jim DeRogatis, former Chicago Sun-Times music critic, current author, and professor at Columbia College and host of Sound Opinions, for his great work on R. Kelly over the years, and his book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly by Jim DeRogatis. And to you, Jeff Carlin, thanks for being here with me, executive producer of The Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis. And for all of you out there thinking about that tiger burning bright there in the forests of the Southwest Side, you've been on the Chicago Way on WGN+.